Committee, we have just three items on the agenda. We'll take Senate Bill 310 first, then the possible reconsideration of 2849. The Dash 1 amendments are being, there is an error in those, but they are being printed now for each committee member, and then we'll go to Senate Bill 667. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 310. Dave, do you have a sign-up sheet? Nobody wants to speak on 310.
So much for that bill.
Wow, yeah.
Well, you got Senator
Ferrioli.
Is he on this one?
Huh. Ferrioli is in with us, too.
Huh?
Senate President's here.
Four. Committee, we've just been informed that the Dash 1 amendments, that there is one word, it's a very important word in that amendment, and they're redrafting the whole amendment, and it will be available to us after 10 o'clock. So we will put House Bill 2849 kind of on the rear burner until that new amendment gets printed up and we're able to give it to everybody so they can know the impact of that committee. So we'll...
You can come back.
Nobody signed up to talk on 310?
We go ahead and do it until after 10 o'clock. This is only one rule. We know what we're talking about.
We could do that. Let's finish 310. Gosh, I don't have anybody to talk.
I had a comment on that.
Ray, you want to come up and read this bill for us?
That's what it is.
Sorry, it isn't. Senate President was in the wrong room, so in good shape. We're in good shape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 310 requires the county to take action on a permit within the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area within specified time limitations. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure was sponsored by Senator Ferrioli and Senator Metzger. They worked on a committee, subcommittee, this interim that I was the administrator for, and that was the subcommittee of the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, the purpose of which was to study both the National Act and state efforts and the effects of the National Act on the local economy. There were, for your information, three hearings held out in the Columbia River Gorge area. One was in the Dalles, one was in Hood River, and the other was in Cascade Locks, and all three hearings were very well attended by the local populace, in fact, on both sides of the river, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone out there that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 310? The committee, you have a statement from Michael Wang, Conservation Director of the Friends of the Columbia Gorge. We have no one to speak on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I can comment on it.
Representative, I'll tell you what. Let's end the public hearing, and we'll go into a work session on it.
Okay. So, lobbyists for the Central Court was in the hall of living check.
Would you, Randy? I appreciate that. Committee will stand at ease.
Mr. Ray, is this
not an issue? Not there.
I think there's an issue.
Right.
Yeah. Was there an engrossed version or is it just?
Nope. Okay, we'll call our committee back to, from recess. And while we're waiting for Senator Farioli to come down, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310 and Representative Zahner.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Bill 2849.
Okay, Representative Zahner moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2849. Those of the opinion that the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2849 will say aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Greenlech.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
The chair votes aye. The motion carries. The rules have been suspended. It is now in order to accept the motion on reconsideration. Representative Zahner.
Which part of this is? I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2849 was suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote.
Was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
What script are we reading? Was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Zahner moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2849 will be reconsidered. Is there any discussion? Those of the opinion that we consider the vote by which House Bill 2849 was moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Greenlech.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative
Zahner. Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
And the chair votes aye, so therefore the motion carries and the vote on House Bill 2849 will be reconsidered. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2849's reconsideration, reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 310, and say good morning to Senator Farioli. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ted Farioli, members of the committee. On Senate Bill 310, I'm certain that Committee Administrator Kelly briefed the committee on what amounted to almost an encounter group. We had legislative oversight hearings on the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area Act. And let me tell you that it's sort of an aside. I support the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Act. My objective as a representative of that district is to make sure that the bi-state compact is fully understood by the legislature. That the Gorge Commission, which we fund 50% of, functions well and serves the interests of the people in the community in addition to meeting its mission and role, which is to protect the scenic and cultural resources of the Columbia River Gorge and to do economic development for recreation and recreation-related or scenic-related resource activities throughout the Columbia River Gorge. Those are the stated purposes of the Act. We've had great difficulty in getting our federal partners to fully fund the scenic area appropriations, although they've made the appropriations and the dollars are piled up in Washington, D.C., they have not released the dollars that are needed to fully develop the recreation and economic development potential of the area. We're hoping that that will come soon. This issue that's before you in Senate Bill 310 comes out of those oversight hearings that actually were held not just in this last interim, although they were fairly intensive, but have been sort of the result of a couple of years of working with different people in the area. The Act is, on its face, simply requires the county to take action on permits within the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area within the specified time limits that happen to appear in state statute. Watsco County is in the scenic area, and Hood River County is in the scenic area, and Multnomah County has a small portion of the scenic area within its borders. But only Multnomah County consistently misses the deadlines for state law to process permits. And they will tell us that, gosh, you know, the problem we're having is that other state agencies, like the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, can't get their work done on time to do wildlife surveys. Or that the state historic preservation issues are not dealt with in a timely manner by the folks that are appropriately designated to do the historical survey. Or that a federal agency does not have time to do its work relative to cultural resource surveys. But they all have the same 150 days. And if a permittee comes to the Multnomah County Planning Department and makes application for a permit and goes through all the land use issues that they have to go through, plus the additional process of going through the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Area Act siting process, what we find is that Multnomah County occasionally can't seem to get the permit issue. And we have a state law that refers to the time it takes for processing permits. And when we've asked Multnomah County about why it is that they can't do their work in 150 days, they have a list of excuses, but they talk about federal preemption of state law as a legal reason why they're not required to meet the standard that all the other counties in the state of Oregon meet. So we've asked them, if there is a preemption in the federal statutes or the federal rules, the Code of Federal Regulations, please cite the statute so that we know what the conflict is. They have written back to us and indicated that they cannot find any conflict with state statute, or there is nothing in the Code of Federal Regulations or the Bi-State Compact or the enabling legislation for the scenic area that creates this presumption. So if the committee will bear with me, it is a presumed presumption of preemption. So that brings us here before the committee with a simple, straightforward reassertion of state authority in our land use system that requires a decision to be rendered within 150 days. You would think that we would simply be able to say, well, follow the law, tell the truth, and everybody's happy, because we already have these things in statute. The problem we run into is that because the county is still ambiguous about whether or not there is federal preemption, even though they've written a letter to that effect, when permittees go to get a writ of mandamus or to demand that a decision be rendered, even if it's no, they still get into this loop, well, it's federal preemption and we don't have to do this within 150 days. The bill before you is an attempt once and for all simply to say state law is in full force and effect everywhere in Oregon unless there is a preemption that you can point to. It has to be a Code of Federal Regulations site or an enactment that we can point to in the federal statutes, or there is merely a presumption of the preemption, and a presumption isn't enough to hold somebody's permit up, just in a practical matter. But in point, a presumption is not enough to overturn a state law, and we have a state law that deals with our land use process, and I feel very strongly that maintaining the integrity of the land use process, even though sometimes it's cumbersome and sometimes renders the wrong decision, is better than a presumed preemption that leaves people in a legal limbo. So the bill before you simply clarifies the fact that, yes, indeed, Multnomah County is still bound by state law when it comes to land use decisions, and they have a 150-day requirement, just like every other county. And I almost regret having to bring this issue before you, because I would think that the lack of citation from the Code of Federal Regulations or the preemption statutes would be enough to get the committee on board. But I believe this law will clarify the fact that all counties in Oregon are bound by the same state statutes relative to land use. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm hopefully ready to be able to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Farioli, have you sought advice from legislative counsel about this issue?
I have done, and I have a wonderfully ambiguous letter that I'd be willing to share with the committee. The wonderfully ambiguous letter says that it is clear that the governing body of the county must take final action on all permits within 150 days. That's a simple citation of state statute. It also indicates that there could be a federal preemption, but they cannot cite the preemption statute or the rule of law or the federal enactment as a conflict, and nor can they find anything in the bi-state compact that indicates there is preemption. They simply warned me in this 4 or 5 page notification. And I'll quote the conclusion, if I may, for the committee, Mr. Chairman. In conclusion, in sum, we find no specific language that provides a clear and direct answer to your question. We can point to several reasons to suggest that the counties are justified in allowing permit approvals to take longer than 150 days. These reasons are not free from doubt or counter-arguments. However, on balance, we believe the counties are justified. The county has since sent me a letter that says they do not have a preemption basis. So we can fill the room with dueling attorneys, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Rosenbaum. Clearly, it's not to Oregon's interest to have one county that chooses, for whatever reason, not to abide by Oregon land use planning statutes.
Follow it, Mr. Chair. We have some written testimony that suggests it's a constitutional principle, and they cite Article 6. Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution.
That would be the preemption, but they cannot cite the statute, code, or federal regulation that preempts state law, so it's a presumption of a preemption. I think it's well that we are warned that there could be preemption, so long as we do our own due diligence to find the statute, the specific citation, the agreement, the bi-state compact issue, the federal enactment that preempts the state law. I think it is intellectually lazy for us, and I think we all fall into the same trap, to assume that the federal authorities occupied the field and preempt state law. But I think it's also incumbent on us to break through our intellectual laziness and ask to have people actually show us the statute that's preempted. And in this case, Multnomah County cannot do it. Our legislative council cannot do it. I cannot find the citation in any written form that says that we're preempted. And I'll be happy to share the county's letter if you wish to have it.
Representative Greenman.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you for coming. Good morning. I may ask two questions. First, in our administrator's summary measure, he mentions that an applicant may request a reasonable time extension on their own behalf if there's Fish and Wildlife aren't in or somebody in. I don't see that in the particular statute that's being amended. Is it safe to assume that that's in another piece of that legislation?
Mr. Chairman, to represent Greenlake, that would remain untouched. The only thing that would be changed essentially is an assertion of the 150-day rule, but all of the appeal processes and all the other aspects remain intact.
And so an applicant could say, okay, I don't want this denied.
Yes.
And this, I may follow up, sir. I had a conversation with the county on this, and they said that they thought they could live with this quite well, but that one of the consequences might be if they come up toward that 150-day extension and something else is pending, they might just issue a denial, that would be the way that could work with, and then the applicant could appeal that denial. Does that trouble you, or does that seem like what they would probably do? Is that
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Greenlake, I think that is exactly the same due process that every other applicant lives with. I mean, the fact is you get to 150 days, and if the counties are not fully competent or fully confident in their decision, or if there's a piece left out, they do render a decision. The decision is a denial. That at least creates the right within the applicant to appeal, and typically what happens in that appeal process is whatever time was necessary for the county to finish its work takes place, and then the appeal is decided in favor of the applicant. So the due process question for me is probably the most important question here. the idea that, you know, we have a 150-day rule, and that triggers certain safeguards in the system for both appellants and respondents, applicants, and those that might not approve of the application. So citizen review and a whole bunch of other stuff is triggered on that 150-day rule.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I just want to make a short statement for the record based upon the Senator's conclusion that there's no preemption, and I certainly agree with that. My view is if the federal government is going to preempt an area of state law, that it has to do specifically in the legislation, and not having found any, I feel that there's basically no preemption issue here. And I want to also take issue and put on the record in reading on page 3 of the Friends of Columbia Gorge statement that they're saying the federal act does not give circuit courts approval regarding land use applications. The circuit courts only get involved here through a mechanism called the writ of mandamus. When a local agency doesn't operate within law or within time permitted by law, you can go to circuit court and get an order compelling them to do so. In doing that, the circuit courts are not approving or disapproving land use applications. They are exercising supervisory authority over inferior tribunal. So it's a very narrow issue, and I think that is not a correct statement of the circuit court's role. So I just want to put that on the record and get back to the Senator's logic, which was correct, which was legally correct. If you can't find presumption in enabling legislation, it's usually not there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Dan? Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the committee's time and attention and the opportunity to have the bill heard.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 310? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, in addition to what Representative Ackerman has said, the U.S. Constitution also has an enumeration clause, and if it's not specifically set forth in the Constitution or in any of the regulations that relate to it, then the power is retained by the states and the people. And if no one can come forward with that specific application, then this is a state's issue.
Okay. Chair, seeing no further comment, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310 and open a work session on Senate Bill 310. Representative Ackerman?
Chair, I move that Senate Bill 310 be forwarded to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves Senate Bill 310 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, could I just ask the administrator what the vote was on this bill in the Senate?
Representative, it was 19 to 9.
19 to 9?
Yes.
With two excused for business.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Berard.
Chair votes aye. Representative Ackerman, would you do the honors?
Thank you. I will, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 310 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Ackerman will carry. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310. Committee, we do plan on reopening the work session on House Bill 2849 as soon as we get that set of amendments, but they will not be ready until 10. And then I'd like to give the committee a few moments to be able to look at the amendments because we are expecting testimony on it at that time. So what we'll do now is go to Senate Bill 667, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 667. And do we have a... we want to close the work session on Senate Bill 310, for sure. Let's see.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 667 allows aerial fireworks display business operating in exclusive farm use zones since December 31st, 1986 to continue that operation as a conditional use. It provides for alteration, restoration, or replacement of the business use pursuant to alteration process for non-conforming uses. It declares an emergency effective on passage, Mr. Chair.
Committee, this bill passed out of the Senate on a 27-1 vote for the record, and we will bring forth John DiLorenzo.
Chair, may I have my client with you?
Certainly. This includes Bob
Gobay
and Paul
Thollifer.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney representing Western Fireworks Display, Inc., in support of Senate Bill 6678. Also here with me today is Mr. Bob Gobay, one of the owners of Western Fireworks, and Mr. Paul Thollifer, his corporate counsel, and they are also available to answer questions that you may have. Western Fireworks Display has done business in Clackamas County for 55 years. It has been a family-owned business for three generations. It is the only fireworks display company located in the state of Oregon meeting all federal Department of Transportation and alcohol, tobacco, and firearms requirements for the storage and transportation of special fireworks. We are passing out, I think, a volume which you can follow along with, and it's tabbed to several of our materials. The history of the company is appended at tab 4 in case you have any interest. In that, the company supplies 85-90% of the fireworks displays in Oregon, as well as many shows in Washington and in Idaho. It produces displays in Nevada, New Mexico, and recently provided what was billed as the largest display in Minnesota's history. Locally, the fireworks displays produced by the company include the Portland Rose Festival, the Fort Vancouver 4th of July, Oaks Park, Hillsboro Happy Days, the Oregon State Fair, and 4th of July Ivars in Seattle, to name only a few of the 300-plus fireworks displays supplied every year by the company. The company has perfected the art of electronically fired choreographed pyrotechnic displays, and a copy, a picture of a typical display, I think it's the Portland Rose Festival display, is shown at tab 3 of your materials to get you give you an idea of what they do. The company has 12 full-time and up to 600 part-time employees. It is a marvelous resource for Clackamas County. We've included references to customers at tab 5 of your materials. Now, here is a description of Western's predicament and why we are here. Western Fireworks has operated in the Canby area, as I stated, for in excess of 55 years and has always been located on agricultural land. Prior to moving to its current location, the business operated on a farmland parcel off of Southeast 13th Avenue in Canby. Had it never moved, it would have been grandfathered under the land use laws. The business did move, however, to its current location in 1985, to New Era Road, approximately 1.5 miles east of Highway 99. That property is zoned exclusive farm use and consists of 130 acres. The fireworks business occupies a very small portion of that ground. In 1985, the business received a temporary permit from Clackamas County to operate and store fireworks. As best we can tell, the permit was renewed for subsequent year and was never revisited again. Clackamas County has permitted the business to operate on the site continuously since that time. The temporary permit was granted in part as a result of testimony from ATF, which at the time, the regional director stated at page 2 of my testimony, quote, "I am aware that you are seeking a variance from your local zoning plan in order to locate your facilities in the safest location. We concur with your desire to locate your facility in a remote area. We strongly encourage the placement of storage facilities in remote areas in order to offer maximum safety to the general public. It has been our experience that locating facilities in industrial areas with minimal safe distance margins leads to future problems when the licensee is confronted with urban sprawl from neighbors or a necessity to increase the quantities of explosive materials stored. In addition, the issuance of the temporary permit was supported by the Canby Fire Marshal. whose testimony is excerpted at page 3 of my testimony. And the fire marshal then said, quote, from the fire service point of view, we would have a much better chance of containing any fires in the proposed area than at the existing storage area. This office strongly suggests that Western Fireworks Company be allowed to move their operation to South New Era Road. A copy of the ATF letter is appended at tab 6. A copy of the Canby Fire District statement from 1986 is appended to materials at tab 8. Appended at tab 7 is a copy of the ATF's table of distances regarding the storage of explosive materials. And we have placed a line on the table, this is the one at tab 7, to indicate that for the storage capacity maintained at Western Fireworks, which is between 45,000 and 50,000 pounds, no point at Western's facility can be located any closer than 1,400 feet from any barricaded building or 2,000 feet from any unbarricaded building. So as you can see, locating this business in an industrial zone or any other type of zone other than an exclusive farm use zone poses not only a safety risk for surrounding properties, but would also constitute an incredible waste of industrial or commercial space and would not be economically feasible. Now, a former Western employee went to work for a competitor and who does some fireworks business in Oregon. That person filed a complaint with Clackamas County seeking to remove the facility from its current location. That person is here today and I believe is signed up to testify, and you will hear from him. Because the facility does not constitute a conforming use in an EFU zone, Clackamas County's hands were tied. The county does not want to lose a good employer, nor does it wish to deny surrounding localities the benefits of the services that are provided by Western Fireworks. During a meeting that was held at the beginning of the session with Senator Schrader, who is the bill sponsor, and me, and representatives of Western and representatives of Clackamas County, the representatives of the Planning Department and County Council informed us that there were no administrative options available to the company short of legislation. There is no process available at all. It is for that reason that Senator Schrader introduced the bill and why we are seeking your intervention. Senate Bill 667 is printed, was designed originally to make Oregon's only fireworks display operation an outright permitted use in an EFU zone. The bill's application was intended to be limited to an aerial fireworks display business in continuous operation at its current location in an EFU zone since December 31, 1986. While on the Senate side, we engaged in a series of discussions with Thousand Friends of Oregon, which initially stated its concerns regarding our request to make this an outright permitted use. After numerous discussion with Thousand Friends, we agreed upon amendments adopted by the Senate, which are now part of this bill. The bill passed by the Senate makes this type of business a conditional use, necessitating our application with Clackamas County. The conditional use status would allow surrounding neighbors the opportunity to comment and would allow Clackamas County to impose reasonable conditions upon our operation. In addition, the future expansions would be subject to the normal restrictions which relate to expansions in a conditional use context. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have reviewed the bill containing the Senate amendments with representatives of Clackamas County. We are informed they have no objection to the bill as amended. We are also informed that the Oregon Farm Bureau has no objection to the bill. In conclusion, Western Fireworks is a fine business. It is a significant employer, provides a wonderful service to many who enjoy its fireworks displays. Passage of this legislation will ensure the company's continued operation in a manner that does not alter our current land use laws or our current system. We seek your help because this employer just has no other option available and no other process other than legislation. We respectfully request you send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We're here to answer any questions you may have. In addition, if any new issues are raised by other people who testify today, we would also appreciate a very brief opportunity to respond to anything new that's raised. With that, I will conclude. Thank you.
I'm going to add, we have Representative Scott that wishes to testify on this bill. So if I could ask you to stick around, John, and we'll take questions here in a moment. But
certainly,
if I could have Representative Scott come up, and we'll interrupt the testimony of this panel just very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Committee, my name is Wayne Scott, State Representative, House District 39. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 667A. Just to give you a brief history, Western Fireworks has been, I missed part of the testimony, but it's been in Canby for a great length of time, and the family has lived there all their life. It relocated into a exclusive farm use area that kind of fell between the cracks as to why it has gotten this far. But it has, and I just want to state the importance to Western Fireworks to our area, how much the county wants to retain it in the county, and how much Canby would love to retain it as a major employer. On their area that they store these fireworks, they continue to do a farming operation also, and the vast majority of their land is farmed in conjunction with operating their business. So I would encourage you to look favorable. I think it would be extremely extremely beneficial to Clackamas County and to the Canby area. Thank you for your time to allow me to address you.
Any questions for Representative Scott? Seeing none, thank you, Wayne, very
thank
much. John, would you like to bring the panel back up now?
Sure.
And I apologize for the interruption.
Mr. Chairman, at this point, we're available just to answer questions, which you or your panel may have, and we're also available to respond to any matter that may come up.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Council, if this legislation is passed, am I correct that your client will still have to go through the conditional use process with the county? Would that be correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, that is correct. That's the way the bill is designed.
And in the conditional use process, is the permit usually granted for a specified period of time, or is there some periodic review?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I believe the permit will likely be issued for a lengthy but finite period of time. There will be then another opportunity to review it. That's my understanding, unless counsel is I'm informed that it could also possibly be for an indefinite period of time, but of course these are always open then to review from time to time.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you.
Bill Zuber. Committee, by the way, you've just been handed your amendments to House Bill 2849, the -2s. Good morning, Mr. Zuber.
Good morning. My name is Bill Zuber, and my wife and I, we own a 14-acre Christmas tree farm out in the Clackamas County area. And a couple years ago, I attempted to establish a fireworks business in Clackamas County in Beaver Creek. We continue to maintain an empty ATF explosive magazine on the property. It's empty because when we applied for our business license and stuff with Clackamas County, we were denied, the use of our property for that business. It all came down to we were approved on everything else. State Fire Marshal approved the site. Like I say, ATF approved the site. But the way the zoning laws are at Clackamas County, the storage of explosives on agricultural forest land, exclusive farmland, what have you, is not allowed unless the explosive material is used for what the land is designed for. Like a rock quarry can have dynamite stored on their property for blasting. On a forest land, you can have a container full of dynamite for blowing stumps, but you can't have a small amount of fireworks. having worked for Western in the past, like they said, I know that their property is zoned comparable to ours, so I went to the county to find out how they were able to operate on their property. When I got a hold of Mr. Steve Marshall, who is a he's a senior environmental specialist for the Community Environmental Division. He told me that the property had been zoned for that particular use back in the early 80s. And so I explained to him the situation that I had found with Western, and that they had never obtained any permits for any of the buildings on their property except for a mobile home, double-wide mobile home that was supposed to be used for a residence, but was never used for a residence. All of their explosive magazines, all the electrical power, everything on their property had been done without any permits, without any county inspections. OSHA even did an inspection of their property, and they got written up for not having any, for having non-compliant explosion-proof lights in their magazine. In talking with Steve Marshall, some of the stuff that in a letter he wrote back to me that was also forwarded to their attorney, it said that in researching county records, it appears that Mr. Gobay had several staff temporary permits approved. Approved in 1985, and the last permit, file number 11-88ST, expired September 14, 1999. The basis for the approval of the last permit by the Planning Division was that the applicant actively pursue an alternative for the temporary use. It was indicated there were plans to submit language to legislation to change the governing statutes ORS 215, which would allow this type of activity through a conditional use permit. In reviewing ORS 215, it appears that this change was never approved and made law. Thus, based on the best information available to the county, it appears that this commercial activity is in violation of Clackamas County Zoning and Development Ordinance. Then he goes on to also talk about that he reviewed the permits for the buildings, the bunkers, loading dock, and other things that had never been approved by the county. basically, what this Senate bill is going to do is it's going to reward one company who has violated county laws and ordinances and knew that they did it. We would strongly recommend that this bill be not passed, and that we would be in favor of the wording of the bill being such that other companies like myself could also have explosive magazines in Clackamas County. Like they said, it's minimal use. Our 14-acre Christmas tree farm where our magazine sits takes up about a 50 by 50 area. It's in an area where we can't plant anything anyway. It doesn't hurt a thing. And anyway, that's about all I have to say.
Any questions of Mr. Zuber? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Zuber, it sounds like you're mixing two different issues and you got a bit of sour grapes in the middle of it. You're indicating that you don't want this passed because they, the other business did not go through proper channels, and then you're also saying, but we really would like to be able to have the authority to do this as well, and those are separate issues. If this business has been in business for a long time, has a good record, is unable to qualify because of a technicality in the law, that's one thing. If what you're really saying is that to approve a bill that would allow one company to do what others might do, that's a separate thing. And so it seems to me that your better argument would be that this is too restrictive, and that if it would apply for one company, it ought to be allowed for others, since the testimony by Mr. DiLorenzo is that because of the requirements for spacing, it's essentially impossible to have this type of a business within the urban growth boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're really looking for is an opportunity for this kind of a business to be allowed in an area that normally would be exclusive farm use. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. The bill as it sits right now, I would like not to see that passed. Mm-hmm. But if it could be reworked to say just what you said, that somebody else who wanted to be in the business could, I think it would be a fairly simple thing to do. To allow other businesses. The way they worded it, that a company that's been in business since 1986, on their property, they're the only ones that would ever meet that criteria of this bill. If it would allow other companies to be on their agricultural property or forest property, what have you, way out in the woods where it doesn't affect anybody, that's what we would like to see done, yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Borders, did you have a comment?
I have nothing to add.
But you have to identify yourself. Okay.
My name is Laura Borders. I'm a retired nurse living in Clackamas County in Beaver Creek. And I would fully support the passage of a revised amendment that would allow other companies rather than just that specific company to be allowed to work on agricultural property. We agree that its footprint is very small and the explosives are probably much more safely stored in remote areas where they don't draw attention. And so long as that can be accomplished in a legal manner, we just think that other companies ought to be allowed to establish a business in the state of Oregon on the same basis that Western is established, other than their long-standing practice. I mean, yeah, they're the only folks in town at the moment.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Okay. Very much. The chair would like to give Senator Schrader an opportunity to speak on his bill, so we will try to bring the bill back for a work session when the senator is available and for his comments. John, did you have any additional comment that you'd like to make?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just a brief one.
Once again, for the record, John DiLorenzo on behalf of Western Fireworks. Mr. Chairman, although we have no, official position on the scope of the bill, I think it's important to stress that when we met with Senator Schrader, his first concern was whether there were any processes available to us, and he wanted to be convinced that legislation was the only alternative, and that was the purpose of our initial meeting with Clackamas County. After that meeting, the senator was very concerned that we write the bill as narrowly as possible, and so we did that. In addition, there were concerns raised by 1,000 Friends in the Senate as to a conditional use versus an outright permitted use. We very carefully negotiated amendments with 1,000 Friends to satisfy their concerns and to satisfy any concerns the Farm Bureau would have. And as you can probably more than speculate, the political environment is a little different on the Senate side than it is on the House side, and so we had to be especially concerned with fine-tuning this bill in order to limit opposition. I think we did a good job of doing that, working out all of our questions with all of the interest groups that were concerned at the time. So to the extent that you consider the request for an expansion of the bill, we don't have a position on that, but I would caution the committee to be very concerned about the temperaments on the Senate side and the instructions that we were basically given and which we followed. I'd like to also give Mr. Gobey an opportunity to respond very briefly to a couple of the suggestions that were made regarding his operation.
First of all, we've been inspected by numerous state agencies that were, all the agencies that we were inspected were all contacted by two individuals, Mr. Bill Zuber and Brian Bischoff, and we've been inspected by Oregon OSHA, DOT, DEQ.
Sir, you have to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Robert Gobay. And so we've been through every federal and state agency under, you know, that they would ever regulate the company. We're in good standings with everyone. Clackamas County has inspected all the complete process and all the structures to address the that the there is a mobile home. It was a residence. My aunt lived there. There was a residence that originally had burnt down in the early or the late 80s, and it was replaced by a mobile home. The county allowed us to use a portion of the existing building for an office. It was a residence. The one that we replaced it was a residence with my aunt for numerous years. She since has moved away, and it is not a residence. But to address the questions that were presented, we've been inspected and are in good standing with all the agents. Thank you.
Committee have any questions? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, and I'm concerned, obviously, I know what you went through to get this, but I, you know, about fairness, it would be nice if they could also operate a business in the county. I'm sure you're not afraid of competition, and that's why I'm struggling with, not with my throat, but with the bill at the moment. Is there some way we could work that in so if they could also qualify to operate a business in Clackamas County?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, as I stated earlier, we're neutral on that issue. I think your question is more properly posed to the other interest groups with whom we engaged in negotiation on the Senate side. Some of them are here, so maybe... I hate to put him on the spot, but maybe Mr. Tucker could respond to that one. I guess our position is, if all the parties who we were required to negotiate with on the Senate side would be open to that suggestion, we certainly would not have an objection to that. Right, but our interest is in passing a bill to remedy an immediate problem. And if legislation does not pass this session, this entire operation will have to close down, and its employees will be lost to the county. And that's the reality that I am facing.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to make a statement in regards to Senate Bill 667A? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 667A, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2849. Committee, you have the new -2 amendments. Mr. Honeycutt, Mr. Day, would you like to come forth and explain your amendments? And Mr. Tucker also would like to speak. Mr. Administrator, would you like to give a brief overview for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2849, the -2 amendments, they replace substantive parts of the original measure. What the bill does, or what the amendments do, is they define terms and requires a governing body of a county or designee to establish one or more rural zones and allowable uses thereon, and it specifies the conditions for establishment and provides the county with the option of planning for development of rural zones without adopting an exception to land use goals related to public facilities and rural to urban land use transition. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. And let me, as you committee is aware, this bill has been before you and was referred out and then referred back into committee by Representative Zahner. And I took note of the comments of Representative Ackerman about the drafting of the original bill. It was the original bill wasn't drafted in the way that conveyed, I think, what I was trying to get at. And if you look at my letter, that's probably in your file, one of the things that I take pride in is that the things that I at least indicate that if the bill is going to do something and I indicate that that's what the bill is going to do, then it certainly seems to me to be my responsibility to make sure that the bill does what I'm saying in the letter it's going to do. So with that, let me walk you through the dash two amendments to House Bill 2849, and I'll explain as we go through them essentially what it is that we're that 2849 is trying to get at. The purpose, the dash two amendments do is they amend, essentially gut and stuff the bill. The concept is the same, but the language is completely different. Sub one of section two contains the definition, the statutory definitions of Eastern and Western Oregon, so that we define for purposes of this bill what's Eastern Oregon and what's Western Oregon. And then sub two of section two starts off with the governing body, and that's line seven starts on line seven of the dash two amendment. Says that the governing body of the county or its designee shall establish one or more rural zones on those lands that, and here's all the qualifiers. And the language that you'll see from lines 9 on page 1 through line 8 of page 2 essentially tracks exactly, with one exception which I'll talk about, the language of goals 3 and LCDC's goals 3 and 4. LCDC's goal 3 is their agricultural goal. LCDC's goal 4 is their forest goal. So starting on line 9 of page 1, the rural zones that we're talking about in this bill do not apply to lands that are located in Western Oregon, composed of class 1 through 4 soils. That's the first definition in goal 3 for Western Oregon of agricultural land is lands in Western Oregon that are composed of predominantly class 1 through 4 soils. This sub 2A, lines 9 through 11 on page 1 explicitly provides that the rural zones that would be established under this bill do not apply on lands in Western Oregon that are composed predominantly of class 1 through 4 soils. From lines 12 through 14, that's sub 2B, in Eastern Oregon under LCDC's goal 3, their agricultural lands goal, class 1 through 6 soils in Eastern Oregon fall within the definition of LCDC's definition of agricultural land. And this bill specifically provides that the rural zones that would be created under this particular bill are not allowed to be created on lands in Eastern Oregon that are composed of class 1 through 6 soils. So the soil class test in LCDC's goal 3, Western Oregon class 1 through 4 soils, Eastern Oregon class 1 through 6 soils, it's clear that the language provides that the rural zones created under this bill would not apply on those soils. Of course, Goal 3 also has additional criteria for their definition of agricultural land. It's not just Class 1 through 4 and Class 1 through 6, Eastern or Western and Eastern. It's also additional land, and that's line 2C. Our sub 2C beginning on line 15 of page 1 of the dash 2 amendments, those lands that are the rural zones would not apply to lands that are suitable for farm use as defined in ORS 215-203. That's the definition of farm. There's a definition of farm use in 215-203, taking into consideration soil fertility, suitability for grazing, climatic conditions, existing and anticipated availability of water for irrigation, existing land use patterns, technological and energy input requirements, and accepted farming practices. So in other words, in addition to all of the lands in Eastern Oregon that are 1 through 6 soils, predominantly 1 through 6 soils, all the lands in Western Oregon that are predominantly 1 through 4 soils, rural zones would also not be allowed on lands that would otherwise be suitable for farm use. That's class 7 and 8 soils in Eastern Oregon. There's 8 soil classes. Class 7 and 8 soils in Eastern Oregon and class 5 through 8 soils in western Oregon that could conceivably be suitable for farm use, taking into consideration all the various the soil fertility and suitability for grazing and all the other things that you see on lines 16 through 19 of page 1 of the Dash 2 amendments. In addition to all of that land, this bill would also not apply sub 2D, lines 20 through 21 of the Dash 2 amendments, to lands that are necessary to allow farm operations or practices on adjacent or nearby land. So in addition to the 1 through 4 and 1 through 6 soils and all and the additional soils that are suitable for farm use, even lands that aren't suitable for farm use but are necessary to allow farm operations or practices on adjacent or nearby land, this bill wouldn't apply to those either. That takes care of LCDC's Goal 3, their ag lands goal. Lines 22 through 24 on page 1 of the Dash 2s deal with Goal 4, and that's LCDC's forest goal. And what we're getting at on lines 22 through 24 of page 1 of the Dash 2s, the bill wouldn't apply to lands that are acknowledged on or before January 1 of this year. So all lands that were acknowledged by LCDC as of the 1st of January of this year as forest land, essentially every county's got a forest zone, so nothing that's zoned for forest use this bill wouldn't apply to anything that's zoned for forest use. Now we go to page 2, lines 1 through 3, even if the land wasn't zoned for forest use, if it's suitable for commercial forest uses or is necessary to allow forest operations or practices on adjacent or nearby land, this bill wouldn't apply to those lands either. And of course, then we get to the catch-all in Goal 4, LCDC's Goal 4. The catch-all language you'll see on lines 4 and 5 of page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments are not forested lands that maintain soil, air, water, and fish and wildlife resources. So essentially, what you're getting at on those first with those first two definitions, no Goal 3 lands and no Goal 4 lands. And we've used the language straight out of Goal 3 and Goal 4 to describe that those lands. So this bill wouldn't apply to Goal 3 or Goal 4 lands, agricultural or forestry land. Lines 6 through 8, which is sub 2H, lines 6 through 8 on page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments describe exception lands. Now, that was one of the arguments with the original bill. Does the bill apply to exception lands? I wanted to make it clear that it doesn't, and the exception lands are those lands that fall within the definition of ag land under Goal 3 or fall within the definition of forest land under Goal 4, but for some reason, either the property itself is built in a way that wouldn't allow agroforest practices. The uses of the surrounding land make that area committed to some type of use other than agricultural or forestry, or there's what's known as a reasons exception. But for some reason, there are lands out there that fall within the definition of ag and forest land under 3 and 4 for which the counties have taken an exception. This bill, lines 6 through 8, make clear that this bill doesn't apply to those lands either. It doesn't apply to the exceptions lands, unlike one of the bills that you debated on the floor, 2689, I believe it was, a realtor bill. This bill doesn't apply to exception land. And so, essentially, what we're trying to get at is when it's all boiled down to it, is about 84,000 acres, according to the DLCD, 84,000 acres, less than 0.25% of Oregon's land mass, that are within an exclusive farm use zone, but don't meet the definition of agricultural land or forest land. These are lands that have been miszoned. What brought about this case was a situation in Crook County where the Crook County Planning Commission, the chair of the Crook County Planning Commission, asked me this question. He said, just because the land doesn't meet the definition of agricultural land in Goal 3 or forest land in Goal 4, does that mean we have to take it out of an exclusive farm use zone? And my answer to him was no. You can still keep it in an EFU zone, but if you want the planning program to work, you would think that land that doesn't meet the definition of ag land or forest land wouldn't be located in an agricultural zone. This bill essentially says if the land doesn't meet LCDC's definition of ag or forest land, you don't have to, the counties, you're going to place that into rural zones. Now, the counties then are allowed to plan for those rural zones, and that's lines 9 through 19 of page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments. Lines 9 through 13, subsection 3 of section 2, provide that the governing body of a county, when they establish these rural zones, is still required to plan them consistently with the acknowledged comprehensive plan. So in other words, when a comprehensive plan gets acknowledged by a county, there's a finding by the by LCDC that the plan complies with all of the various goals 1 through 19, and from citizen participation through ag and forest lands, through the natural resources goal 5, through the coastal goals, which are I think 17, 18, and 19. Every county in the state has an acknowledged comprehensive plan. This bill, the Dash 2s, make clear that the counties, when they're planning these rural zones, have to comply with their acknowledged comprehensive plan, which means they're complying with goals 1 through 19 of the statewide land use goals. Now, lines 14 through 19 of the Dash 2s contain an exception to, and I shouldn't use exception because it gets confusing. It's an exception to subsection 3. Essentially what it says is that the counties have to comply with all of the goals 1 through 19 except goals 11 and 14. Goal 11 being public facilities and services, and goal 14 being rural to urban land transition. The reason for that, although the counties under this bill would be required to create rural zones, not urban zones, LCDC has language that prohibits parcel sizes smaller than 2 acres, rural residential parcels smaller than 2 acres, and so the idea being here, if we want to give the county some flexibility to conceivably to create half-acre lots, which I would consider to be rural, over here, and 40-acre parcels over here. I'm trying to give the counties, or I'd like to see the counties have some flexibility, and I would hope that the committee would too. So the idea with this bill is we're affecting less than 0.25% of Oregon's land mass, and we're affecting, this bill would affect lands that don't meet the definition of goals 3 or 4. I've taken out all the language that Representative Greenlick and I had a little bit of a go-round about regarding the coastal goals and the Willamette River Greenway goals. It's drafted more clearly, which I take heed to Representative Ackerman's comments. I think they were appropriate, obviously. And so from a policy perspective, there could be a disagreement, but I think the bill does exactly what I say. It's what we were trying to get at with this bill. And again, it affects just 84,000 acres in the state and gives the county some flexibility on those lands that would have absolutely no impact on ag or forest land.
Any questions for Mr. Honeycutt?
Comment,
Mr. Richards.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Honeycutt, thank you for coming in. It's nice to deal with policy issues rather than specific don't gore my ox or please gore somebody else's. I appreciate the comments that were made on the floor earlier this week last week about that very issue of we need to try and deal with policy that will allow us to make changes that are reasonable. And in this instance, where you're trying to deal with land that's outside of urban growth boundaries, that is obviously and shown as by designation not to be farm and not to be forest, then I appreciate the attempt and I support this bill.
Representative Greenland.
Yes, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I do appreciate you getting rid of that language. It was making me nervous on coastal and dunes and stuff. I have two questions, if I may, a specific and a general. And on line 7 of page 1,
I'm still learning as a rookie. I'm having a little trouble with may, shall, and must as a word. I would understand this if it said may, and it doesn't say must, but does the shall lead you to believe that every county in the state would need to have at least one of these zones?
Chair Garrard, Representative Green Lake, the shall is a, and I need to address something that I was, that I almost neglected to address, but the answer to that question is no. It is mandatory, so the governing bodies of the counties would be required to establish these rural zones, but only if the governing body of the county had some of this land, which I think most of us in land use parlance refer to as non-resource land. For those counties that had non-resource land, then yes, they would be required to establish these rural zones. Now, although they'd be required to establish the rural zones, the actual uses that would occur, there is no requirement in this bill that they actually establish any particular use. They conceivably could continue to limit uses to whatever the uses were in the exclusive farm use zone if they so chose. We would obviously hope that they would take the would recognize that this land, since it isn't agricultural land or forest land, that there'd be some type of alternative uses. If you want to direct growth, provide some growth in the rural areas where most people, if given the opportunity, would choose to live, it seems to me prudent that you would direct it onto these areas that aren't ag and forest lands. The answer is a qualified yes.
It is a... It doesn't say may, so it's
correct.
Goes.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. I'm trying to get a sense of what this means. So if we talk about the more general thing. I mean, I see an agricultural area, and then there's this rural zone which can have public facilities, it can have residences that are not rural residences, it can have any number of things in it. I mean, so is it, would what we're trying to do here, as I imagine it happening, is to produce in the middle of what's an otherwise agricultural part of this of the county, what's a sort of rural use zone. I mean, you could do sort of, a sort of urban zone. I mean, you can then in that zone do all sorts of things that you could not otherwise do on rural land. Is that the sense?
Chair Garrard, Representative Greenlick, again, it's a qualified yes. Qualified by two things. Number one, there's a requirement that these zones be rural in nature under the express language of the bill.
Where is that required?
That would be on line 8 of page 1. They'll establish one or more rural zones. And then the other qualifier is, I don't think, Representative Greenlick, that you'd find these in the middle of a farm zone, because remember under LCDC's definition of agricultural use in Goal 3, and you'd find this on lines 20 and 21 of page 1 of the dash 2s. The lands that would be necessary to allow farm operations or practices on adjacent or nearby land, even if they're class 7 or 8 soils, and even if they're not suitable for farm use, are nevertheless fall within the definition of agricultural lands. The definition of ag land, and someday I'm hopeful that we can have this debate, but the definition of agricultural land in Goal 3 is so broad, in our opinion, that that essentially it takes into account all rural lands. But we wanted to make it clear with this bill that we're not going there on this bill. We're not getting into that debate. So the idea that you'd find these in the middle of a productive farm area, I don't think is accurate, because on lines 20 through 21, on page 1 of the dash 2s, even if the land is a rocky outcropping, if it was necessary to allow farm operations or practices on adjacent land that it could actually be used for agricultural use, it would still fall within the definition of ag land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Garrard, there's one other thing that I neglected to mention that I want to mention. Having had conversations with Mr. Slack from the AOC, I believe that this bill would have major 30 constitutional implications in that, as Representative Greenlee pointed out, on lines 7 and 8 B-2s, it requires the counties that have these lands to establish these rural zones. So it would impose a requirement on the counties, which under Measure 30 would then require some funding from the state to allow the counties essentially to correct their miszoning. So the state would be required to pay the counties to correct, to rezone, to properly zone these lands. But nevertheless, because the state, because this bill contains a mandate on the local governments, I think
that's unfunded mandates. Measure,
yeah, it has a Measure 30 implication, which I would assume would require a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Any other questions for Dave? Representative?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Honeycutt, would that be alleviated by changing the shall to may, and then it becomes a local issue as to whether or not the counties want to do that or not, and so they have the power that they don't have now, but they're not mandated to do it?
Chair Girard, Representative Richardson, it would. The problem, the heartburn that I have with that is there are some counties that currently that have a non-resource zoning designation, but there are some counties that I believe would have land, part of those, some of those 84,000 acres that would fall within this definition that don't have and won't have non-resource designations. They essentially will continue to have land that's miszoned. That would be a reasonable compromise. We personally would like a shot at convincing the Ways and Means Committee that it's an important part of our land use planning system. If we're going to have a statewide land use planning system, it's important enough to spend the additional money to allocate the money to the counties in the form of grants so that they could actually go out and fix these problems. And from our personal preferences, we'd like to have the shot at the Ways and Means Committee to convince them of that.
Art, could you come up for a moment? Do you have a comment in regards to an unfunded mandate on the counties?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Art Slack, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And as you recall, when this bill was initially heard, I did not speak to it. However, in review of the Dash 2 amendments, it is clear the way the bill is crafted at this point that there is a Measure 30 unfunded mandate to counties. And it will require all counties to go through a process to determine whether any of these lands are in that county at this point, and then to take the other steps to develop zoning districts and regulations to manage those. Because of the Measure 30 at this point, the Association of Oregon Counties would have to oppose this bill unless there was funds with it at this point. I would note for you that in review of DLCD's budget that's going through the Ways and Means, Natural Resource Ways and Means Subcommittee.
Or it's not going through.
Or not going through its budget. Both the co-chairs and the governor's budget at this point have taken additional hits to grants to local governments at this point. So we at this point are very concerned about any additional mandates. We know that there will, because of the interest in jobs and industrial land, there will be legislation that will direct us towards that effort at this point during this next biennium. So I can only offer to you our concern with this. We have on the books, I guess, what I would call the alternative that may not go as far as this piece of legislation, and that is regional problem solving. And I have always thought that regional problem solving was a way of dealing with these kinds of issues. Again, it would be discretionary rather than mandatory, and it would not bring with it exceptions to existing goals like 11 and 14 without the exception process. But it would provide a county to go through a process to identify lands that had been miszoned. Mr. Honeycutt and I have talked about it. The problem with regional problem solving, while it is exists in the statute, there was a budget note, and the legislature chose to not fund the regional problem serving the regional problem solving process. This last biennium, so there's a funding problem with that too, but it's something that exists in statute that could address this issue.
Okay, thank you.
Randy?
Ron, do you want to come up too?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon. First of all, let me say, well, you probably recall when I testified on this bill the first time around that there was a significant variance between my interpretation of it and Mr. Honeycutt's. And I will say, even though we continue to oppose the bill, that I appreciate that the bill has been greatly clarified and at least somewhat narrowed by the elimination of the elements relating to the coastal goals. And I agree with you, Representative Richardson, this is at least a policy question, and I appreciate that we're in that terrain. We, however, continue to oppose House Bill 2849. That's the number, right? Yes. When I appeared before you before, I called this House Bill 2689 on steroids, and now I would say it's House Bill 2689 on a diet, or on slim fast, or maybe the mini me of House Bill 2689. It applies to different lands than House Bill 2689, which essentially exempts exception lands from Goals 11 and 14. But it essentially applies to additional lands and exempts those lands from Goals 11 and 14. And so it's essentially an add-on to a bill that we strongly oppose, and we have a similar concern about this bill, that it will, despite what Mr. Honeycutt says about it requiring rural development, I don't interpret the bill as actually requiring rural development. It says that the governing body or its designee shall establish one or more rural zones, but then it goes on to say that those rural zones need not comply with the land use goal that ensures that they remain rural, which is Goal 14, and to a lesser extent, Goal 11, the public facilities goal. So,
Randy?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, I'm just having a little trouble following you here. Using my district as an example in my head, okay? We have a lot of non-resource land,
right,
that falls just outside the urban growth boundary. My assumption is that this bill would allow the local government to make the decision what to allow on that NR land that presently isn't being used for agriculture, isn't being used for forestry or anything else, but would allow the local entity to make a decision as to whether or not they wanted to put an industrial site or a commercial site or a residential site on that land. Am I right there? And how do you oppose that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that your interpretation is correct, and Ron can correct me if I'm wrong about that. Here's my, and I don't know the map of your county and where these lands are.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be specific.
No, that's fine. I'm assuming for the sake of this discussion that it's exactly like you say, that the lands are right outside the urban growth boundary. In which case, I'd say if you need that land for urban development, then there's a process for expanding your urban growth boundary. And it's urban development. The basic principle behind House Bill that we think is violated by both House Bill 2689 and by this bill is that urban development goes inside urban growth boundaries. That's what the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in the Curry County decision back in the 80s. We believe that's a fundamental premise of the Oregon Land Use Planning Program. And this bill essentially says you can have urban development outside urban growth boundaries. But we need urban, we should think that urban uses should be maintained inside UGBs. Now, in limited circumstances, the program does provide for exceptions to those goals. And in fact, we've just reached agreement on the Senate side on House Bill 2691, which is the mill bill, which would allow industrial uses on certain lands outside urban growth boundaries without of urban intensity without taking exception. We think that those kinds of statutory routes around the exceptions process should be limited, and this bill is not in our view. So if you want to develop that land at an urban scale, then we believe there should be either an expansion of the urban growth boundary or there's an exceptions process when there's a reason to allow that. So it's not clear to me exactly how much land this bill applies to. In a discussion in the back of the room, Ron was saying there are at least 80 some odd thousand acres of this land statewide. That's a lot of land to exempt from goals 11 and 14. And so I wonder if that answers your question.
Well, I'm still struggling a bit with the fact that this is non-resource land.
Right.
And I cannot understand anyone who would object to, say, five-acre parcels or something like that on non-resource land, which is basically right. Land that's just sitting there and not being used. How can you oppose...
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a different question with respect. Five-acre parcels, at least according to the rules we have governing rural residential land, are considered rural. And so that's a different question.
Okay.
What Mr. Honeycutt referred to, half-acre parcels, are not considered rural. We don't consider that a rural use of land. And so there is a need, I believe, for some sorts of standards to govern the development of these non-resource lands. And yes, they are non-resource lands. They're not farmland. They're not forest land. We all agree on that. That doesn't mean that it's appropriate, cost-effective, or a good development pattern to allow any kind of development at all, whatsoever, on them. We still, if they are rural, we want to maintain them in a rural use. We don't want to be extending public facilities out there, at least without considering that and taking an exception, et cetera. And we think, as I said, that there is a need for some standards relating to non-resource land. We would go a different direction in the content of those standards than this bill would go and that Mr. Honeycutt testified to. I believe I've covered all the points that I jotted on the back of the envelope here this morning. So,
okay, Randy,
unless you have more questions, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you, and I appreciate your response. Ron? Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Three issues. One raised to you that are concerned in the department. One from Mr. Schlack about how this would require counties to go out and do something and divert them from other planning priorities in terms of urban area development would be one of our concerns. Counties do have the authority now if they want to designate non-resource lands. Counties have exercised that. I believe there's about 84,000-86,000 acres. I think most of it is either in Josephine, Klamath, or Cook counties. I grabbed the wrong file this morning. I apologize, so I can't tell you exactly where it is. So it would, and as Mr. Tucker has pointed out, it would allow urban levels of development in these rural non-resource zones without an exception, and so even though they're labeled rural zones, they would really have all the attributes of just further urban development without going through the existing planning processes. And then finally, I appreciate Mr. Honeycutt's attempt at narrowing the bill so it says more closely what he said it did. I still believe that there is an issue with the coastal zone. We have lands on the coast that are zoned, that are not agroforest lands. They are in specific coastal zones, whether it's a coastal shoreland zone or a beaches and dunes zone, that have not had exceptions taken. And so as I read the bill, there's still, I think, a question that a jurisdiction could zone those for rural development and urban levels of development inconsistent with the coastal goals. You know, we haven't seen the bill in gross, but I still see that as a potential concern.
Mr. Chair, one brief follow-up comment, I'm sorry, if I may. Randy Tucker, again, 1,000 friends. Mr. Schlack alluded to the cost aspects of this bill and also to the fact that right now there is actually looking to be cuts there are, in the grants to local governments. And I would just like to add to that in this fiscal climate and considering the great level, the very significant level of cuts that the department is facing in its ability, which would impact its ability to work with local governments around the state in order to do the things they really do need to do, and that really will enhance economic development more efficiently and effectively. I would argue that this is not the best use of the limited funds that we have if we want to spur economic development.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Okay, committee.
What would you get, work session?
We are in a work session on 2849. We'll need, this is going to have to be referred to Ways and Means. And we have the dash two amendments that will come up first, but we'll wait for Representative Doyle to return, so the committee will stand at ease. Oh, here he is. Okay. We're back.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2849.
Representative Zahner moves the dash two amendments be adopted into House Bill 2849. Any discussion? Seeing none, dash twos. Well, we'll call the roll. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Berard.
Chair votes aye. The dash two amendments are adopted into House Bill 2849. Representative Zahner.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2849 as amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass.
Representative Zahner moves House Bill 2849 as amended to a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
No.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2849, as amended, is referred to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Committee, we're going to reopen the public hearing on, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 667A. First, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2849, and now we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 667. Do we have a motion? Representative Doyle.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 667A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Doyle moves Senate Bill 667A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative
Greenwood. Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Garrard?
Chair votes aye. Representative Doyle, would you like to carry this?
I would think Representative Scott.
Oh,
I might want to be there.
You're absolutely right. Representative Scott. Senate Bill 667A is passed, and Representative Scott will carry. Committee, thank you very much. Good work, and we will adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Land Use at 10:18.
I must have missed something.
Thank you.